Okay, well, welcome everyone to our weekly Dhamma study group conducted via Google Docs and audio from the Sri Mangalo site. I was given some feedback last week that I should let people know in advance when the class is going to be, and because last week I only gave like an hour's notice, forgot to give an earlier notice. Hopefully Nick can help to send notices out as well, or arrange something. But the thing he didn't realize is that this is actually, it should be quite clear when it is, because it's a weekly session, and I think the problem has been on our part not making that clear enough. So just to be clear that this is a weekly thing, and unless, barring some natural disaster or internet problems, we'll be holding it every Saturday at 2 p.m. UTC. And if you come to study.sirimangalo.org, you will see at the top there two times: next broadcast time and the time now, and it should be localized for your time zone in parentheses. So just to be clear, if anyone hasn't realized that, you don't really need a notice, you just need to put it in your calendar and show up at the right time. But we will try to get notices out there, and there's a neat feature for sending out emails. The problem is it gives the wrong link, which, you know, we can deal with. So for those of you who are new, just to sort of lay the groundwork, lay down some principles, or the way we're going to go about this. First of all, the tone of the session will be dictated by the input from the group. I'm the only one with audio, and that isn't by design. That's just the way it has to work for now, and hopefully that can change somewhat in the future, and people will be able to input a little easier. Hopefully we'll have easier ways for people to input, but for now you have text, which, you know, maybe in the long run the way we will go anyway, because it does keep it orderly, but it just doesn't give you a voice, and it means I have to do all the talking, which, believe it or not, isn't my favorite pastime. So feel free to butt in with questions, with comments. Yeah, if you have comments, if you don't agree with some, or if you want to clarify something I say and add something to what I say, just make sure you know what you're talking about and you've done some studying in the Pali Tipitaka. We don't just want comments flying all over the place, but if you do know something and you want to share something about what we're studying, please feel free. I think that's a good way of adding to the session. And I will just go through the text at my own pace and deviate when something else comes up, something related. And go according to questions. So if no one asks questions, it'll just be the way I am going with things, and if people ask questions, then it might be completely different, and I think it will be a lot more interesting if people do ask questions. So please don't be shy. I'll try to take all questions, and I'm happy to get them. So, if you haven't seen yet, we're at the The part where it says we are here, that's why it says we are here, because that's where we are, that's how far we've gotten, and that will move every week. If I remember to move it, I'll move it down, or maybe Nick can move it down to where we end, so that next week everyone knows where we're starting. So off the top, if anyone has any questions, please feel free to ask them now. Their questions about what we went over last week or about what we're about to go over or about something later on in the text. It really doesn't matter. If there's something that's of interest to you. I suppose people don't come in here all week and study the text and think up questions, so I'll excuse you if there are no questions, but I'll open it up now, maybe give a few moments for people to reflect. And the other thing is, as I've said before, my idea is I'd like this to be immersive. I don't want this to be a intellectual exercise entirely. I think it's impossible to avoid some intellectual mental activity, and it is going to be fairly intellectual, but as Buddhists and Buddhist meditators, it behooves us to be practical in everything we do, because theories and views are detrimental, not only useless, but actually have a detrimental effect on our minds. So rather than be content with views and opinions and theories, we should reflect and put into practice right here and right now the things that we're studying. So if no one has any questions, I will just get started. So, idang dukhang arya satchanti. That's where we're starting. And he's Nyanamoli has interesting, especially in this text, he has quite an interesting way of translating things. I mean, it's literally just saying this is the noble truth of suffering. This is the noble truth that is suffering, or literally, this is the suffering noble truth. And so here we're going to we already talked about the truths last week. Here we're going to talk about what we do with them. And this is where we're going. If you look at the note, there are the three parts, three aspects to each truth. It's called the tipariwatta, and we'll see the Buddha use that word down below. Tipariwatta, pariwatta means to go around, or going around or something like that. So it's the progression, you might say. The threefold progression. So the first thing you have to do is understand what is the noble truth of suffering. And that we covered above. This is the first thing that the Buddha realized. Pubbe ananusutesu dhammesu cakkhung udapadi. And the eye arose. And here we have this metaphor. This metaphor of the eye. It's funny how these things have been taken over time. Some people think this refers to the third eye, so you actually see something. And that's not the case. There are many kinds of eyes in Buddhism. The Buddha gives a list of them. There's five, I think, or six, I can't remember. Buddha Chakku is the Buddha's knowledge as a Buddha. Mangsa Chakku is the physical eye. And then there's I can't remember what they all are. Then there's the Dipachaku, which is, that's the one where you actually see something. That's the third eye. Dipachaku is angel eye. Dipa means angel or heavenly or divine. So it's like magical. But that's not what's being talked. What's being discussed here, I think, is either the Buddhachaku or the Dhammachaku or the Jnanachaku or something like that. See, if we chaku karani, we have. Yeah, I believe he's talking about the Dhammachaku. Because that's what we're going to see come to Anyakundanya. So chakku ngudapadi, jnana ngudapadi, and these are all, again, just synonyms. Panya is wisdom, vidya is knowledge. Here he says finding, but it really means experience or just knowledge. Aloka, light arose. And then here is the practical part of the Buddha's teaching that really outlines, it's something that I think we don't often get when we, in an introduction to the Four Noble Truths, and you have to dig a little bit deeper, and we don't often think about the 12-fold reckoning of the Four Noble Truths, which is really the practical framework that is Buddhism, and what makes the Four Noble Truths so important is the fact that the Dukkhang Ariyasatyang Parinyayang. Now, let's look at the word parinyayang, and it doesn't mean to diagnose. I think he's off base there. He may be smarter than me. It's very likely. But in this regard, he might know something that is not clear to me. But pari means thoroughly. Completely. And where do we see this? We see this in the word, for instance, parinibbana. If you know parinibbana, it's the complete release or complete emancipation. And then nyaya. Nyaya equals should be known comes from our friend the Nya Dhatu. Nya Dhatu should be quite familiar to us by now. Jnana, the word Jnana comes from Nya Dhatu. Panya also comes from Nya Dhatu. The root Nya. So it really means it should be known thoroughly. And this is an important definition. To just translate as diagnosed, yeah, he's appealing to this idea of the Buddha being a doctor, I guess. But it really misses a very, very important point, that this is practical. That dukkha is what we have to look at and what we have to understand. If you wanted any practical advice that the Buddha could offer to us, it's to learn everything you can about suffering, to understand it thoroughly. And what that means is to understand those things that we cling to as being sukha, as being being happiness. To come to see them for what they are, that they are really not happiness, and that there's nothing that we could cling to make us happy, nothing that we could hold on to, not inside of ourselves, not in the world around us, not our computer, not our home, not our family, nothing. So actually, this is another important point here, is that when the Buddha talks about understanding suffering, he's actually not talking about focusing on the unpleasant side of life. But you might argue that he is being pessimistic, if you want to use that word, because he wants us to come to understand that everything that we cling to is suffering, or everything is suffering, painful, in the sense that if we cling to it, it's going to disappoint us. Right? We went over this. It's suffering, but it's only suffering for those who cling to it. There's nothing suffering about living. But what it means here is basically that everything is unsatisfying, unable to satisfy, unable to bring happiness. It's like fire. Fire is hot. No matter who touches fire, they all get burnt. But if someone doesn't touch fire, they don't get burnt. So this is what is meant by dukkha. And so people do argue that Buddhism is therefore quite pessimistic, but they don't really understand the profundity of it. The Buddha is not trying to get us down. And you know, this is one argument that has never really hit me as all that impressive. I mean, I had no problem thinking about, you know, yeah, suffering. Yeah, it's a big part of life. I think the problem is rather that people are unwilling to look at suffering, unwilling to examine the reasons why they suffer and where their suffering comes from. They just want to run away from it, no? So there are four ways that we can understand dukkha. Let's stop here and talk a little bit about dukkha and how we can understand it. I think I must have given a talk about this before. My teacher's always going on about this, always repeating this one. But there are four kinds of suffering. Dukkha vedana, dukkha sambhava, dukkha lakkhana, and dukkha satya. Dukkha vedana is referring to a painful feeling. This isn't the noble truth, but this is how we all understand suffering. We understand suffering to be when I have a toothache or a backache or a headache, or when something unpleasant happens, like someone yells at me or says nasty things to me or criticizes me, or when something I love disappears. I lose a friend, I lose a family member, I lose a possession. When things change unexpectedly, we get this painful feeling or this unpleasant feeling in the body or in the mind. And we say, that's suffering. So how do we get rid of that? That's what we say. And then we have this problem because, well, apparently the only way to overcome all of that is something called transhumanism. And transhumanism is apparently putting... The idea is to put the mind into a robot. Substitute the brain and the whole body with a machine that can somehow support consciousness, which, you know, sounds potentially possible. Well, no, could be possible, and I don't want to say either way. But the idea being that then you could somehow control these feelings or eliminate these feelings. But this isn't the truth of suffering. It's a misunderstanding of the Buddha's... It would be a misunderstanding of the Buddha's teaching to think it was, but it's a misunderstanding of what is actually the problem. Because, as we're going to see in the second noble truth, the problem is really the next noble truth. That's really where the problem lies, or that's the cause. That's the sickness. And so getting what you want all the time and being free from any kind of painful feeling actually makes the sickness worse, right? Because every time you get something that you want, it reinforces the habit and the expectation to get what you want and sets you up for further disappointment when you don't get what you want. This is something we see very clearly in meditation. It's a reoccurring theme among meditators to come to the teacher and say, "Oh, I had a wonderful day today." And then the next day come back and say, "Oh, I had a terrible day." And then the next day, "Oh, I had a wonderful day, and I'm really getting it now. I'm really beginning to get the hang of it, and all my, you know, it's not bad anymore." And then the next day come back and, "Oh, I don't get it, and it's impossible." And this is all because of clinging. It's all because of our setting ourselves up for the fall, having expectations and prejudice in regards to our experience. So this can't possibly, overcoming these can't possibly, and why? Because it's not permanent. There's no telling where the mind, if the mind can go into a machine, then the mind can come out of a machine, and it can create more physical bodies in the future. This has already been talked about, right? You don't need a robot to do it, just practice tranquility meditation or transcendental meditation and become a god. It lasts apparently for eons, or an entire eon. But it's not permanent. And so the second type of suffering is dukkha sabhava. And dukkha sabhava, you could translate as the suffering as a part of nature, or suffering as a natural existential phenomenon. Existential in the sense, I guess, it exists. It's a part of life. Suffering as a part of, as intrinsic. That's maybe what you say. Suffering as being intrinsic. And this is in terms of the sufferings that you can't get rid of. Mental anguish, mental dislike, mental disappointment. But actually talking about old age, sickness and death. These are dukkha sabhava, things that, kinds of suffering that can't be gotten rid of. The decay. So even machines break down and have the potential to change. The fact that you can't keep anything forever, that everything disappears. And this is more obvious than talking about abstract sci-fi concepts. You know, in real life we get old, we get sick, and we die. And when these realities come to us, we come to realize suffering on a higher sense, that it's not just a feeling that can be gotten rid of. Because if, when people think of dukkha vedana, they think, well, then I know how to get rid of suffering. I just take drugs or pills or go to see a doctor or divert my attention and I can get rid of this. So they delude themselves into thinking they can be free from suffering. But then comes the person who sees that suffering is intrinsic in life, and that actually it's a part of the very fabric of reality, that everything changes and disappears. And good examples are people who get old, and as they get old they realize, they start to lose their sense of invincibility. And they realize that something is amiss, and that something more needs to be done than just run away from the problem, because there are certain sufferings you can't run away from. They find themselves without any solution, without any quick fix. And this is what often turns people to meditation, when they realize this. People always say it's people who suffer a lot that for whom Buddhism appeals. But the reason it appeals is not because of the suffering, but it's because of a profound realization based on the suffering, that there are some types of suffering that you just can't get rid of. There's nothing you can do about them. So the idea of learning to accept them, understand them, in this case, parinyayam, parijanati might be the word, I'm not sure. Parin, what is the original verb? I can't remember. The noun is parinya, which means full knowledge. And so this is what leads people to meditate, the second type, but this still isn't understanding the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Truth of Suffering. So the third, then people come to practice, and when they begin to practice meditation, they come to see the third type of suffering. And this is dukkha lakkhana. Dukkha lakkhana is seeing the inherent characteristic of suffering in each and every phenomenon individually. So dukkha sabbava is just coming to see that it's intrinsic, but it's still a general understanding of it being a part of nature. Dukkha lakkhana is actually seeing the three kinds of suffering: suffering based on change, suffering based on being painful, and suffering based on requiring work to maintain. Seeing this in our ordinary experience. So right now, when we're sitting here and we're listening and trying to be meditative, where do these three arise? Well, the intrinsic suffering is pretty simple. You might feel a headache, you might feel a backache or toothache, or however you might feel uncomfortable. And this comes and goes. This is but this is intrinsic suffering. You come to see because of the change, you know, suffering because of change, so that you cling to something, you feel content, and then it disappears and you're unsatisfied. Maybe you've just had something to eat and so you're content, but then after a while that wears off and you get hungry again, and so you want something more. Maybe you have some tasty snack and you're eating that, and it's great. But then once you've had it, then you want another one and another one, and so on. And then you're left unsatisfied when they're all gone, or when your physical body is full. So because of change, because of the inability to sustain an experience, right? We listen to a song and we think it's so wonderful. But if you listen to the same song for hours on end, it's not so wonderful anymore. Or the same with food, same with everything, really. It has to do with the way of the mind and the fact that things change. And moreover, the dukkha lakkhana, in this sense of change, it means to see everything arising and ceasing. And actually, seeing suffering clearly doesn't mean you suffer. It actually doesn't mean you suffer. You don't suffer by seeing suffering. It actually means you become free from suffering. Just like a person who knows a fire is hot and comes to understand that doesn't suffer from fire anymore because they don't grab at it. This is what happens in the mind. You're actually seeing the uselessness of the phenomenon, you know, phenomena. So you might see something, and ordinarily you see it, and wow, that's beautiful, or oh, that's ugly, or I like that, or I don't like that. Then you hear sound. Maybe you hear my voice, and it's nice, or it's not nice. You like what I say, or you don't like what I say, or you like it, and then someone starts shouting in the other room, or playing loud music, or banging on the wall, or so on. Maybe the phone rings and upsets your calm and tranquility. But as we begin to meditate, we come to see this, and we see that it's causing us suffering. And as we see that, these phenomena arise and cease again and again, we start to lose interest in them. We begin to see that seeing is just seeing, and actually what we're seeing is just an illusion. It's a creation in the mind. And when you see another person, maybe a beautiful or an ugly person, you make up this all in your mind. You make up ugly, you make up beautiful. You create it all. Dogs find each other beautiful. Humans find each other beautiful. Apparently dung beetles even find each other beautiful. I read something that there's a certain type of beetle that actually finds beer bottles beautiful and tries to mate with beer bottles. And that's the sort of illusion that comes up in the mind. So it's just seeing the impermanence, no, things arising and ceasing. And you can see this just by watching the stomach, for example. I've talked about this before. As you watch the stomach rising and falling, you'll see that there's an experience that's coming and going, rising and ceasing. There's the mind that's with it or not with it, coming and going as well. Thinking about this, thinking about that, there's feelings that arise and cease. So this is the impermanent side. And the non-self side is seeing that things really go according to their causes and effect, that there's no control. We're not really in control. So when the stomach rises, well, we find a lot of suffering comes because of the delusion. Because of the way the mind works, it still has a belief in control. And therefore, much stress and suffering arises in trying to control, or in that is manifested as the attempt to control the breath, to keep it smooth, or to keep it deep, or to keep it comfortable, to push away unpleasant experiences. And pushing away doesn't really get rid of it. It's not because we're not actually in control. It just creates more and more stress. It gives rise to an energy of sorts, that is stress energy. So we watch the rising and falling, for example, and we begin to see that controlling it, trying to make it this way or that, is doing just this. It's creating dukkha. No? This is where the dukkha is coming from. So we see the dukkha lakkhana. And they actually see the three characteristics: impermanent, suffering, and non-self. The fourth type of suffering is the Arya Satya. Arya Satya is really just dukkha lakkhana, but it's a realization that that is the truth. It's a moment where the mind gets it and says, wow, it says, everything is unsatisfying, or everything is useless, or everything. Everything, no? Every arisen phenomenon is unsatisfying. It loses all interest in arisen phenomena. And this gives rise to the experience of Nibbana, or it leads to the experience of Nibbana, where the mind retracts, comes back inside, and gives rise to no experience of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, or thinking, which is considered to be a nibbanic experience. We'll get to that. Okay, so these are the four types of suffering, and the understanding of what we mean by the dukkha arya satya. Okay, so everyone, still no questions, no? Viskid Mark is saying Tanissaro uses comprehended. So I would say we should go a lot, we should be more passionate about that. This word is a very important word, and shouldn't use dry words like diagnosed or comprehended. Fully understood, I think, is probably the best I could come up with. Or I would want to at least say fully comprehended. But you know, literally nya is just to know. Bari is thoroughly or fully. So to thoroughly understand might be a better one. But we have to be emphatic here, because it's a fairly emphatic word. It's not just to know or to comprehend, it's to really know. Thoroughly. And that's, that to me is a stress. He's putting stress on this. You have to know this thoroughly. This is the key. And this is really the whole of our practice, is coming to understand this. And this is what the Buddha understood. He understood that we should actually look at the suffering. We should actually look at our experience instead of trying to transcend our ordinary experience. Life exists if everything empty arises from zero and back to zero. Well, everything that arises ceases, and that's what Anya Kondanya will realize at the end of this. But there really is no zero. Beings that still have ignorance are constantly giving rise to new things. So I'm not sure exactly what the question is. I'm sorry. You'll have to maybe be a little clearer. Well, emptiness is a characteristic of all phenomena, all arisen phenomenon, all phenomena. Even Nibbana has the characteristic of emptiness. Empty means empty of a self, empty of any ability to last, you might say. Empty of impermanent, empty of permanence, empty of... No, not permanence. Nibbana is empty, but it's empty of a self. It's not... It still doesn't have any inherent core. There is no entity or being. So things don't go to emptiness. Emptiness is a quality of things, as being empty, as having no core, having no self, having no ego. So when something arises, yes, it comes from nothing. When it disappears, it goes back into nothing. And that's because it's empty. It's just like an energy, if you will. It's something that has arising and has cessation. And the cessation is complete cessation. There's nothing left, like an ego or a being. This is why Nibbana, when we talk about Nibbana, people say, oh, it's you know, cessation or nihilism. It's the annihilation. And then you have that, well, the annihilation of what? Because everything is annihilated every moment. There's nothing that isn't annihilated. The problem is we have all these things that we cling to as me and mine, right? This is my body, this is myself, this is my... my life, my ego, my memories, my thoughts, my knowledge. We want all of that to carry on. Right? We like to remember things. We like all these memories that we have. My memories. And so we get an idea of who we are, our self. When we break it down, we see that it's just lots and lots of experiences. When you say that the senses retract and Nibbana comes to you, I never said Nibbana comes to you. Now, I'm not trying to be picky, but it is important because Nibbana doesn't come. Nibbana is the experience where, and it's not that the senses retract either, it's the mind that retracts from the senses. So in Nibbana there is no light, there is no sound. Yeah, but... See, the whole idea of you are cut off from your senses, actually I probably should be a little bit more exact. It's not really even the mind retracting. It's the momentary cessation, momentary or eventually complete cessation of the senses. Cessation of the arising of the senses. Because they cease anyway, they come and they go, they arise and they cease. But that doesn't happen for some time. And that's the experience of Nibbana. So during the time of Nibbana, a meditator will be still breathing and will look just like they're meditating. Sometimes they will slump a little bit. It looks like maybe that they're sleeping. But quite often they're fully upright. And a good meditator will be fully upright. And it will look like they're just meditating normally. They don't look asleep. But at that time, there is no seeing, no hearing, no smelling, no tasting, no feeling, or no thinking going on inside. So if everything is nothing, is it any life form, or everything just flashes from nothing? Well, not everything is nothing. Everything is empty, but empty doesn't mean nothing. But yes, everything just flashes from nothing. We really have to understand, and this is something that we should understand in regards to the Four Noble Truths and all of Buddhism. And let's be clear about this, and you may not agree with me. Let's hope that we can come to agreement. If not, then so be it. But to give you an understanding, what we're looking at here, Buddhism is... Many people say Buddhism is practical. But I think it goes further than that. Buddhism, the theory of the Buddha, and as far as I can see, the Buddha's... It's funny to say theory. The Buddha's understanding of reality was... in a framework of practicality. So the idea that something exists or doesn't exist, the idea of a for instance a physical reality that exists outside of experience, the idea of things being this way or that way really doesn't doesn't seem to be the way the Buddha looked at Buddha understood things. The Buddha didn't even answer such questions, for instance, as is the universe deterministic. He said we shouldn't hold such a view that the universe is deterministic. And so we have a problem here, because the Buddha is talking about everything being non-self. Well, if there's no self, then shouldn't it be deterministic? I had a conversation about this a few days ago. And it really points to the difference between the way we nowadays look at the universe and how the Buddha and people in the time of the Buddha looked at the universe. It wasn't in terms of pinpointing the way things are. Which, you know, in terms of practicality, is useless. It's useless to have knowledge of, you know, the way the universe works, or laws of gravity, or laws of relativity, or so on. In and of themselves, it serves no purpose to know the truth, to know what is the truth. The purpose is served by understanding and by seeing clearly the way things are, the way one's own experience is. So we're not trying to come to any theory. This is very important. This is really how the Buddha's teaching is set up. If nothing exists, what worry about? Gives me a deep calm. Yeah, sure, except that calm is something, and so if that calm doesn't exist, then how are you experiencing it? I mean, this is all just pointing to theories. Does it exist? Does it not exist? It's really pretty useless. There's no point of reference by which you could come to an answer. Except to say that, well, I'm experiencing it, so in that sense it exists, or it has arisen here. You know? So to say it doesn't exist or it's nothing is really, really incomprehensible. And I think Therefore, it's very important for us to focus on the experience rather than the theory of what it might or might not be, or so on, or even what its characteristics are. We should look at the characteristics of the experience. So when you have that deep calm, see, the problem is that you may be attaching to the deep calm. And in that case, you're setting yourself up for the First Noble Truth, more suffering. It comes from clinging to the calm. But, okay, but maybe that's being a little bit too cynical, because it is true that when you stop worrying about things, when you stop seeing things as being, really when you give up your views, the idea that something is going to bring you happiness or satisfaction, that's really what it's all about. You notice that the three characteristics are framed negatively. We're not trying to realize anything about reality. We're trying to give up our understandings about reality. So we look at something and we say, oh, that's beautiful, or oh, that's ugly. But we're not trying to become pessimistic so we think everything's ugly or everything's awful. We're trying to give up our idea that it's ugly or that it's beautiful, that it's good or that it's bad. In meditation, observing the arising of sukha, the disappearance of dukkha, why is this moment not the end of dukkha? Well, actually, the sukha is also dukkha, to tell you the truth. It's one of the five aggregates. It's the Vedana aggregate. And we talked about this actually before. Sukha is dukkha because it's not permanent. Anything that arises ceases. This is the truth that Anya Kondanya realizes from this. And moreover, it's the attachment to it is going to give rise to dukkha. So when it disappears, you'll be disappointed. You'll be left unsatisfied. You'll always need more. And that leads to the third type of suffering, which is the work that is required to maintain it. If you want that back, you have to work for it. And it's because it's not based on wisdom and understanding, but it's based only on the formation of certain mind states and bodily formations. It's again just going to disappear, and then you have to work for it again and again and again. Okay, so here we've gotten past the First Noble Truth, I think, fairly comprehensively. So, number two, idang dukkha samudayang arya satchang. This is the noble truth of the cause of suffering, or the origin. The origin of the truth. And again, he's doing funny things here. He's couching, or he's hedging, or I don't know what the word is, but he's couching this, and it loses a lot of its potency. Can be abandoned. That really sounds intellectual to me. The idea is the Buddha's trying to give us some kind of theory, but it's really an order. It should be abandoned. Let's see if I can find it here. Where is it? Searching. Bahata Banti. That is not can be. It is certainly not can be. In almost every case, Dabba. If you look at this word, Bahata Bang. Dabba means should be, or it's fairly forceful actually. It's like a judgment. It should be done. Gata Bang means should be done, not can be done. So he's not trying to give us this intellectual theory that the truth of suffering can be. He's saying, I realized that I should get rid of this. I should throw this out. It's a judgment. It's not a theoretical, oh, I could abandon it if I wanted to. Or, oh, I have the ability to abandon it. That's not what he's saying. Uh, And it's because he's not talking about the origin of suffering. He's talking about, or like just as an abstract concept, he's talking about tanha, or craving. The realization that it should be destroyed, given up, bahataba. And this word bahataba, or bahana, if you look in the Sabhasava Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 2, if I'm not mistaken. Very good sutta, one that I always give talks on when I go to places to give talks, because it's just so complete. And it takes about an hour and a half to go through it all. So it's a good one to give a talk on. And it uses the word pahataba. Samvara pahataba, the defilements that should be abandoned or rooted out through guarding or through restraint or so on, through seeing, all of the different kinds. So this is a very important word, the pahana. It's one of the great efforts, is to give up or to root out. So he's talking about giving up our craving, and it really comes from the First Noble Truth. We give up craving once we see clearly or understand thoroughly. Once we understand thoroughhly the first, or the nature of reality as being not sukha, once we see that even the pleasant feelings and the peaceful feelings and the stability that we have in life, we see it's not that. It's not satisfying. It's not stable. It's not lasting. Once we see that, we give up craving. It's quite simple, actually. Quite logical. Brilliant. Beyond brilliant. It's Buddha. This is the masterpiece from the master. No? Something quite exceptional we have here, these Four Noble Truths. So I'm going to say quite clearly, this word should be must, even maybe not must, but should. And you know, it's not exactly a judgment. It's an actual visceral realization that lets go, that sees, oh, this is causing suffering. As a result of the vision, it's like untying a knot. There's no more the clinging. There's no more this. The third noble truth, the cessation of suffering. Let's see how he translates. Yeah, this is another one. Oh no, verified. Verified. It's like when you sign up for a website. And then you get this email and it asks you to verify. Maybe it made more sense 50 years ago when he translated it. But the word verified is not a good one either. Oh, it's a terrible one. Because here we have a wonderful word, and I'm going to talk about this. Okay. Satchikattabang. Satchikattaba is an interesting, very interesting word. And I know some of you are interested in this. If you're not, I apologize. You'll have to bear with me. Let's see if I can... Satchikattaba, to make with one's eyes, I think. Let's go to the dictionary. I want to get this right. But I've dealt with this word before. It's quite... Right, yeah. So let's see. Let's see what the Pali English Dictionary has to say. Sa plus ax, as in aki. Aki comes from I. And so this changes into Satchi. And Katabang just means should be made. This is what I said before. Katabang. Katabang should be done or should be made. So this is a really difficult one to translate literally, because it literally means should be made by one's eyes, or should be made visible, you might say. But we translate this one, and it should be translated as should be realized for oneself, or should be empirically realized. This is one of those big words. It's probably just a translation, or it's a parallel to the word empirical, or empirically. It should be, so, yeah, the word experienced works. It's often translated, I think, that way. It's a good one. But I wanted to break it up so you understand what we mean by this, because words like experienced or so on, it's a very good translation, but it misses, well, it's probably a good word that they'd use, but it's always nice to delve deeper so we understand exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about seeing, as though seeing with your eyes. And the word kata might imply this, that it's actually a simile. Make it as though you were seeing it, you know, as though you saw with your own eyes. So basically it means you experience firsthand. And this is, I think, goes without saying how important this is. We're not going to sit around discussing Nibbana, no? There's not much to say about Nibbana. This is why the Buddha says, you have to experience it. Ehi passa, come and see it for yourself. You have to see it to believe it, kind of thing. Or it's some, no, that's not what it means. It means it's to be realized. This is the goal. To be realized for oneself. To be experienced. And again, he uses the word can. No, we have to change this. It should be, I'm not going to change it because he's the translator here, but it can be verified, should be, has to be seen for oneself, or at the very least should be seen for oneself, should be experienced, should be self. See, we have no word like this. Sa comes from for oneself, or with, could be personally realized. So such was the vision. And one thing I didn't mention here, I didn't talk about yet, is what he's talking about. Pube ananusu tesu dhammesu. In regards to dhammas, in this case truths or ideas is fine. And truths might be better, or facts or reality. Ananusutesu, not heard before, pube, not heard in the past. No, it's not a big deal, but this is referring to the fact that this is the first time. And this is why this sutta is so powerful. When you chant it, it's quite powerful. Because as you're thinking about the Pali words, and as you're understanding what, and it's going through your mind, you know, if you understand the Pali, it's an excellent one to chant, because it really brings great, what is the word, sangvega, brings great emotion to the mind, and brings great power and sense of urgency. And also pasada, which is great faith in the Buddha. And you think of how wonderful this is. This is the arising of the Dhamma. So it's kind of like this this build-up as you chant it, because here we are, this is the arising of the Dhamma. And you get in your mind this idea of what it must have been like. The whole world, the whole universe must have been quiet at that moment. And then the Buddha, boom, explodes with the truth. And the light arose in the world. This has never been heard before. This is it. This is the beginning. So in the fourth noble truth, we've already talked about. But what does he say about this? Here he's got an okay one. What is it? He uses the word developed. And again, he's using can, and the word is not can. I mean, hey, he's a better translator than I am, but I don't believe it. It shouldn't be can be developed. It's not a very good way of spreading your teaching. It's fairly wishy-washy, actually. No, should be developed, is to be developed, at the very least. And the word here is bhavetabang. Where's the word bhavetabang? Bhavetabanti. The T is just, in Pali, this is what they used for quotes. You see T at the end of everything. T just ends the quotation. So what did the Buddha realize? He realized bhavetabang. No, what does he say? Tangko panidang dukkha nirodha kamini patipada ariya satchang bhavetabang. That's what he realized. So it ends with ti, which is just a quotation mark. Bhavetabang comes from the word bhavati. Bhavati means to exist. When you put an e in there, bhaveta, bhaveti means you make it exist, bring into existence. And again, the tabba on the end, or the tabba, means should. Bhavati equals or bhavak comes from the bhu, the root bhu, which means to be. And the E signifies causative. So causes to be or become. And again, our tabba ending just means should. So yeah, they often use the word develop. But so we understand what we mean by the word develop. We mean cause to become, or bring about, or encourage, or foster. But yeah, we use the word developed. Bhavana. The word bhavana is a common one that we use. Bhavana means mental development. We have samatha bhavana and vipassana bhavana. Two kinds of mental development. So he has, I agree with the word development here. Just thought it would be nice to understand what the word is. So should be developed. And the word is dukkha nirodha gamini. I believe at the top he doesn't use the word dukkha nirodha gamini to talk about the Eightfold Noble Path. Dukkha, we all know what dukkha means, no? We have dukkha and nirodha. Nirodha, because this is the cessation. It's talking about the truth of the path which leads to the cessation of suffering. Gamini means that which goes to. That which goes. Nirodha means goes to the cessation, dukkha of suffering. Patibada. Patibada doesn't just mean path or way, it means the method or the way of practice. the well, way might be a good one. Bhavitang. Bhavitang means has been developed. So he's making a, this is the fourth noble truth. When we get to the next paragraph, we'll just jump right in here. The next paragraph explains what the importance of these things are. See, it wasn't enough when he understood the Four Noble Truths. It wasn't enough when he understood what had to be done. The reason for saying, and then it was understood, and then it was abandoned, and then it was realized or experienced, and then it was developed, is because that's the completion. It's kind of, you might say it's a little bit pedantic to spell it right out, but that's very important in the Buddha's teaching, to spell it all out, to be precise, to be exact, and to get it all in there, so that there's no doubt left over. It's razor sharp. And these 12 aspects of the Four Noble Truths are the entirety of what it takes to become enlightened. So before I understood these four, these 12 aspects, or before my knowledge, and here's an interesting word, yatha bhutang, as it is, jnana dasanang, knowledge and vision of things as they were, as they are, not suvisudangahosi, was not perfectly or well purified, was not quite purified. So up until that point, I didn't claim in the world of its gods, its maras, maras the evil demons or Satan kind of, and there's the word high divinities, which just means gods. In this generation, with its monks and Brahmins, or shamans and Brahmins, Samana Brahmana, with its princes and men, to have discovered the full awakening that is supreme. So before I realized these four things, see, because up in just before this, he realized some other very profound things. He remembered all of his past lives, or he remembered his past lives and was able to go back further and further to see what he had been born as. And then he realized this was the case with all beings, and he saw beings arising and ceasing, being born and die. But the key here is that all of that, and everything he learned from his two teachers, and everything he learned in past existences, and everything else that he knew and understood, it wasn't enough to make him a Buddha. And he didn't claim, before this point, he never claimed. And he's also, it's a way of countering the doubt that arose in these monks' minds as to whether how could he be enlightened? And who was he to come and claim this now? But he's making a point here that I never claimed this before. And I would never have claimed this. I would never have a right to claim this without these knowledges, without the knowledge of the Four Noble Truths in these 12 aspects. I would never be able to say anuttarang samma sambuddhing abhisambuddho. So I don't have to spell that all out. It's just, he's got a good translation. The full awakening that is supreme. Anuttara is actually a little more. Anuttara means unexcelled or with nothing higher than it. Samma means right. Sambodhi means full awakening. And this is common in Pali to put two words that basically mean the same thing right after each other. Samma sambodhing abhisambuddho. It's actually, if you wanted to spell it right out, you'd have to repeat the translation, because it basically both words mean almost the same thing. But this is how it goes. You realize the realization in the Pali language. The realization of the realization, in this case. The realization of perfect self-realization. Or the higher self-realization of perfect self-realization. It's in Pali idiom. Paccanyasing. I did, but sannyasing means I didn't claim, or I didn't make known. But yato, from the time when the Four Noble Truths with the 12, with their 12 aspects, from the time that it was known, then I did claim and to have discovered the full awakening that is supreme. Okay. So where do we go? There's not so much here. I mean, it's just a proclamation, but it's a very important pronunciation or pronouncement that before his realization of these Four Noble Truths in the 12 aspects, he didn't claim what is, you know, the highest claim possible. And that's not only saying, that's not bragging about Buddhism as having the highest claim. He really is making the highest claim possible, that he is fully enlightened beyond, or to the highest extent possible. And he uses the word anuttarang. And the word anuttarang means with nothing higher. Uttara means above or beyond. Anuttarang means with nothing beyond. So he didn't say that, and he wouldn't have made that claim without these realizations. But as soon as my knowing and seeing of how things are was quite purified in these 12 aspects, in these three phases of each of the Four Noble Truths, then attahang, then did I claim in this world with its gods, its maras, with its angels, its maras, its gods, and its shamans and brahmins, with angel, with kings and men, or angels and men, you might say, anuttarang samma sambuddhing. So then I did claim. And what came then? Jnanan chapaname dasanangudapadi. Knowledge and vision arose in me. Or the knowledge and vision arose in me. Akupa me vimuti. My deliverance. The word heart isn't in there, I don't think. My deliverance is unshakable, not to be shaken. Akupa. Ayang antima jati. Ayang means this antima, last jati, birth. This is the last birth. Again, interesting, we have the word anta. Anta means the end or the extreme. Remember we had the word, the two extremes at the top? Ayang antima. Just for interest's sake. Ayang anta ima. This is the end of birth, or the final birth. Nati dani punabhavoti. There is no becoming beyond here. Idani, and now there is no further becoming. Beyond this, there is nothing. There is no more. No more arising after this life. That's it. There will be no more because there's no more clinging. It's basically, at this point, there is the slow wearing down, just with a wheel that is still rolling, without anyone to push it. And the wheel keeps rolling and rolling as it will, but with nothing more to push it, it eventually stops. All that's left is to wait for the wheel to stop. Idang avocha bhagava, thus spoke the Blessed One. Attamana panchavagya bhikkhu bhagavato bhasitang abhinandung. funny, the word ti shouldn't be in there. I wonder why it's there. It should be abinandung. Because abinandunti isn't a word, but the ti is again just this quote. Abinandung. Anyway, it's not important. It's getting a little too deep. Idangabocha, that's... So they, as usual, they were very happy to hear this. It was profound. They were probably quite overjoyed to see all the lights and incredible things that happened with the angels making great noise and proclamations as well. But the most important part we have next. Imasamincha pannavaya karanasming. During the time when the Buddha was giving this talk, Banyamane ayasmato kundanyasa. At that very moment, there arose in Kundanya. And Kundanya was the leader of the group of five. And these were the five, according to tradition, they were the astrologers who foretold that the Buddha, the Bodhisattva, was going to be either a Buddha or a wheel-turning monarch, a Chakravarti. Chakravarti Raja, I think, how do you say that? He would have been a monarch who controlled, who emperor of the world. There's two destinies for such a one. This is what they saw in this child's future. But Kundanya only gave one choice. He said, there's no way he is not going to stay in the home life. He was able to see something. And he was able to see that actually it was certain that this boy would have become a Buddha. So the funny thing is that even with all of that, they still were unable to believe that he had realized the truth. Which Mahasi Sayadaw, I think, talks about this, how it shows how deeply ingrained are our prejudices, no? When we believe something. What's this quote? I believe it was Tolstoy. This quote that very intelligent people, it's very difficult even to explain even to very intelligent people something that they already know the answer to. So these guys already knew what the way to enlightenment was. It was to torture oneself. They knew. They were sure. And they were quite advanced beings, so it wasn't that they were dumb, but they were unable to break themselves of it. Until here, Kundanya is able to overcome that. And yeah, so the group of five were actually quite a bit older than the Buddha. The Buddha at this point he was young still, no? He was 35, relatively young. So they might have been 70. Yeah, no, they might have been, 35, add another 25. So, there arose in Venerable Kundanya the spotless, immaculate vision of the true idea.
Mm.
It's quite a translation. Virajang means spotless. Vitamalang. Basically the same thing, with no stain or with no obscuration or nothing to obscure it. With no viraja means without dust, vitamalang with stains removed. Dhamma chakung, the eye of Dhamma. The dust free, stain free eye of Dhamma, or eye of truth. Eye of reality, or vision of reality, arose. What he's trying to do here, actually, he tried in his life to come up with a scheme of one-to-one translation, so he's trying to keep the word Dhamma as meaning idea, and trying to translate it again and again as idea, so... That's why he uses the word true idea. And what did he realize? Yang kinchi samudaya dhammang sabang tang nirodhadang dhammanti. all dhammas that are everything that is of a nature to originate or to come into being. Sabantang niroda dhammam. All of those things, or all of that, or every such thing is of a nature to cease. So this is what we're talking about, seeing the Four Noble Truths. It's not enough to understand that everything disappears or to understand that everything is suffering. What happens is actually this realization that that is true of everything, that everything arises and ceases. And this is really the realization of Nibbana. It means that he's seen cessation. His mind has come to be free from delusion, free from the idea that something is permanent. This is the realization of Sotapanna in this case. It's his first realization of Nibbana, which removes the idea of Sakaya Ditti, or the idea that there is a self or a soul, that one's being is a, or one's the experience is that it, that the idea that the experience of reality is actually a being, is actually someone who is experiencing it, or a person. Vichikicca, the doubt about reality, or doubt about the path, or doubt about the true freedom from suffering, or the existence of Nibbana, or so on. And Silabhata Paramasa, the wrong practices, attachment to wrong practices, because one has realized the true practice. Now, it doesn't mean that he's free from defilements. He still has more to go, more to do to work it all out. The mind is still able to give rise to delusion, to greed, to anger. But it's gotten a start, and it's begun to crack. It's begun to unravel. And so it's only a matter of time before, after this point, Kundanya becomes an arahant, fully enlightened. So next we have this, the narration of what happened then, that when the Buddha set in motion the Wheel of Truth, it was proclaimed by the earth gods. And there's a key here that is mentioned by all of these deities, not to be stopped, not to be unrolled, unset in motion. The Dhammacakka has been set in motion, apattivattiyang, not to be unset in motion, which is what it really means. It can't be stopped, it can't be unpattivatta, it can't be taken out of this state of rolling or of moving forward by anyone. There is no shaman or brahmin or deva or mara or brahma or anyone in the world who can unroll or not unroll, but who can stop the rolling of the wheel, the turning of the wheel. And this was quite true, that once this was set in motion, it was even Mara who tried. And the reason why it's not possible to stop is because of the mind that is free, the mind that is released, the mind that doesn't cling. So no matter if someone were to beat Kundanya up or attack him, they could never get him to go back on what he had learned. They could never get him to believe in. They could never brainwash him again. So it was this spreading of the teaching that was infectious, like the opposite of a virus, but in the same idea as something that is contagious. Nowadays we'd use the word viral. No? We talk about viral videos or viral. I guess videos is the most common. No? We have all these viral videos, or when anything goes viral, an article or a post or something on the internet, it goes viral. And you can't stop it. This is what viral means, is you can't stop it. Suddenly, whereas before you just, you know, throw out all the copies of the article or so on, or trash it, or erase it. Now you can't do that with something that's gone viral. And that's what's really going on here. The truth had gone viral, the Dhamma had gone viral, and it couldn't be stopped. It had passed that point. And so indeed, in that hour, at that moment, the cry soared up to the world of high divinity, the world of the gods, the Brahmaloka. And the 10,000-fold, again, 10,000-fold is just means a lot. So this manifold world element or universe shook and rocked and quaked and reverberated through the universe. And a great measureless radiance, surpassing even the very nature of the gods, was displayed in the world. And then the Blessed One exclaimed, Anyasi vatabho kundanyo. And Anyasi vatabho kundanyo. So he's talking to Kundanya. He says, so you see. So indeed, you see, Kundanya. Yeah, the audio is a problem. No, what's wrong? Okay, so audio is back. Here's a comment. It's interesting that despite all the noisy special effects from above, the Buddha only hears and pays attention to one being realizing something. Well, of course. Why pay attention to the special effects, no? The important light was the light of truth that the Buddha talked about. And so that ends the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. We actually finished it. We went through everything. And that means we need to find a new sutta to discuss next week. But first, any questions? Are there any questions or comments or anything that you felt didn't get discussed that should have, or any questions on what we went through? I mean, it's fairly straightforward stuff. Well, I guess that's it then. It's been almost 2 hours here. I thank everyone for taking the time out of your daily schedule to join us. We can have our weekly dose of the Dhamma from the Buddha himself. So Nick, what's up for next week? I guess we want to go on to the next one. No? We'll go on to the second sutta, second discourse of the Buddha, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. Because here we're left somewhere, right? These five monks aren't enlightened yet. Only one of them became a Sotapanna, and none of them are fully enlightened. We've still got the rest of the story to tell. Right, and if you didn't get all of the audio, I apologize again. It's the nature of living in the forest. Well, it's pretty amazing that I'm able to do this anyway. But the audio is being recorded as I speak, and it will be on the website once I cut out all the parts with me getting up to move the internet modem around. And so you'll be able to listen to that or skim through it or whatever. It's going to be almost 2 hours long. Yeah, there's always problems with any translation. I mean, I think what should be clear is that I'm not offering alternative translations. I'm just, not in all cases, I'm just pointing out how it's it's a deeper than any one word can suggest. So a lot of them are just explaining what is exactly meant. That's why learning Pali is such a great thing, because it conveys the meaning so well. English is a difficult language because a lot of the words have been corrupted and it's hard to understand them exactly. Sadhu with a long A and only one D means it is good. Or just good, I suppose. Learning Pali. You can't easily learn Pali over the internet. I mean, I suppose some people do it. There are Pali resources out there. There's a Pali mailing list on Yahoo that does some good work. I don't know. You really have to take a university course to really learn Pali, or go to a monastery. If you go to a monastery, you can learn with the 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds, where you just mindlessly repeat, memorize. Puriso, purisa, purisang, purise, purisena, purisehi, purisebi, purisasa, purisaya, purisadhang, purisanang, purisasma, purisamha, purisa, purisas, purisehi, purisebi, purisasa, purisanang, purisasming, purisamhi, purise, purisesu, purisa, purisa. That's how you conjugate man. And once you memorize about 20 of those, then you can start to learn Pali. No, Pali's not essential. I mean, a translation works. Translations work fine. But no, they're not exactly. You can see the problems that came up with this text, and those are pretty significant. A couple of them are fairly significant problems and have an impact on how we understand the text. But our minds fill in the blanks anyway. So a scholar reading this will fill in all the blanks in a scholarly way and come up with some theory. There's lots of people. I know one man who... A fairly well-known Pali translator who has read the entire Tipitaka in Pali twice, he says, which is incredible. And yet he has some very, very strange ideas about what actually the Buddha taught. His ideas that, after reading it twice, is that the Buddha taught the power of his speech, or the Buddha's teaching was all about the power that is inherent in speech. And so his idea that people became enlightened just by the power of hearing the Buddha's speech, which, no, it's a pretty absurd theory that he develops. So we do this as well. You don't need an exact understanding of the text to get the gist of it. If you're practicing meditation, you will get the gist of the text and understand what's being said, and it will help to form and to guide and to elucidate and elaborate upon your practice. But the importance is that you're actually practicing. If you're meditating, well, you listen to this and actually trying to relate what is being said to your own experience, then I think you'll regardless of the translation problems, you'll get the gist of it. But you can see it's helpful, and it makes it clearer and makes it easier and makes it more precise to have a good translation. It's not essential, but it's a great thing. Okay, so I guess agreed, we'll go on to the second discourse next week. And so we'll check back in the next couple of days. Hopefully we'll have replaced this sutta with sutta number 2. If people have questions, I'm happy to discuss. I guess I'll switch to text now, but I'm going to end the recording. So that's all for today. Thank you all for coming, and let's all say together then, sadhu. Sadhu, sadhu, and pay homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dhamma, and homage to the Sangha. The three refuges that have allowed us to allowed us to hear, or to experience, or to find the truth. Allowed us the opportunity to hear the truth. So, that's all for this week. Tune in next week when we explore the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the second discourse of the Buddha.